Part 2, Chapter 4. Well, paragraph 7, I'm going to comment on a few details. Now, it's on page 141 for those who are following the text. The first sentence says, in this paragraph, in the world to come, however, there will be no nation other than Israel. No nation other than Israel. My gosh, what's going to happen to all of the Chinese? What's going to happen to all the Nigerians? Not to mention the Eskimos. We won't even put in South Africa. Now, the next sentence says, the souls of righteous Gentiles will be allowed to exist in the future world. So if Chinese are going to be there, and Nigerians are going to be there, and Eskimos are going to be there, I'm not so sure what the South Africans. So what does it mean when there will be no nation other than Israel? The answer is that there's such a thing as a national structure, a national unit. The only national unit that will be there in the world to come will be the Israeli national unit. People from other nations will be there as individuals, no question. And they will be there, in a sense, secondary to the Jewish nation. Now, there are really two points here, one of which is, I think, covered pretty explicitly what I said yesterday, and the other needs a little more detail. If Jews have the ability to complete and perfect the whole of creation, and they have that because they are involved in all 613 commandments, non-Jews have the ability to affect their own spirituality and their own physical conditions, but that's all. Clearly, the world to come, which reflects the perfected state of the world, those who perfected the world are going to have the central position, and those who didn't participate in perfecting the world are not going to have a central position. But that statement contrasts individual Jews with individual non-Jews. Now we say something else. In addition, the Jewish people, all of them, individuals, will form a national unit. And those non-Jews who make it into the next world will not form any national unit at all. They'll be just there as individuals. Now, again, we mentioned this in another connection yesterday. What does it mean to be a national unit? What kind of integrated nationhood can you imagine in the world to come? If you'll ask secular political philosophers, they'll tell you that to be a nation means to have your own piece of real estate that you defend, and to have certain political institutions, and that without that, you're not defined as a nation. Indeed, it means that the Jewish people, for 1900 years, being called a nation was a little bit by cursing, because the 1900 years we didn't have a piece of real estate, and we didn't have any of those political institutions. In the world to come, there's none of that. So what could it mean to say that the Jews will form a nation in the world to come? What you have to say is that having a piece of real estate and having certain political institutions is only... is only the external symptom of a deeper reality, of a more important reality. To have those political institutions and to have a piece of your own real estate reflects the fact that you have a multitude of individuals who can achieve a purpose together, a purpose that can't even be defined in isolation for individuals, let alone be accomplished by individuals. Here's what I mean. Um, Let's take 18 people. Each person can read a book. If there happens to be an automobile parked in the wrong place, and you live in Israel, one way to rectify it is to pick the automobile up and move it someplace else. I've seen this done. People just go around, you know, they gather around on all sides of the automobile, pick it up and move it. Right? That's something which 18 people could do, but one person can't do. That's a difficult task. It's too difficult for one person. It's possible for 18 people. But the task can be defined for one person. It's meaningful to set a person. If a person were very, very strong, it's conceivable that he could do it. But then there are some tasks that are only defined for a multitude of people, like play a baseball game. To play a baseball game, you have to have 18 people, 9 people on a team. Without that, you don't have a baseball game. Here, the definition of the task is for a multitude. It's not that 3 people aren't strong enough to play a baseball game. With 3 people, it's not baseball. Even if one guy could cover the whole outfield, because he's very fast. But without 9 people on a team, it's not baseball. Now, a nation is not just a large group of people cooperating on very difficult jobs. Jobs so difficult that 10 people or 20 people or 100 people can't do it. But if you have a million people, they can do it. No. The definition of a nation is a group of people who are addressing themselves to a task that can only be defined for a multitude. What task is that? The task is not so much external as it is internal. The task is to become a single, integrated working unit. That each person in the nation should define himself in part. It's crucial to put in part here. This is not the total story. Partly crucial because I made this mistake once, and I even published it. And it was wrong. To define himself in part in terms of the role that he plays vis-a-vis the nation. It means that a part of his identity is invested in the role that he plays in the nation. Now, to certain people with a certain mindset, this sounds almost immoral. I'm an individual. I exist for myself and by myself and to myself and with myself. And if I make relationships with other people, it's only because I choose to. What do you mean that part of my identity is invested in other people or in relationships or as part of a larger whole? But this type of individualism is very superficial. The fact is that we are invested as part of identity, part of our core being, part of the meaning of what we do in terms of social structures, without which those tasks couldn't be defined. And that means that part of what we are is expressing a certain aspect of a larger totality. Like democracy, about which we spoke last night. In democracy is a structure of a society conducting its decisions in a certain way, and it's not that 10 people can't make a democracy because it's too hard, they haven't got strong enough muscles or enough money, but there aren't enough people to create the form of activity called democracy. Any art form, any study, any investigation is subject to inherently social standards. The mathematician who burns the midnight oil, dreaming up functions and spaces and matrices and who knows what. Right? When he finishes dreaming it up, and he writes up his paper and submits it to a journal to be published, the paper is going to be evaluated by standards of the International Brotherhood of Mathematicians. And when he writes his paper, because he's internalized those standards, every line that he writes, he's silently criticizing it on the basis of what will that expert in Beijing say, and what will that expert in London say, and what will that expert in Los Angeles say. Because mathematics is an inherently social activity. It's not an individual activity. The mathematician doesn't write a proof that convinces him. the mathematician has the right to prove that it commits all those other people on the basis of the shared standards. Nationhood means a group of people who have adopted a collective identity as part of their identity. Each person has part of his identity, a collective identity, the part that he plays in the role, as a role in the integration of the whole. Then, that group of people who have achieved a collective identity, that group of people has political institutions because they express how this collective identity will take decisions and act. They have a piece of real estate because they need to have contiguity. They have to be joined together in order to cooperate on the activities that they, as an integrated whole, are going to undertake. So, from our point of view, the real definition of nationhood is this, I can almost call it now even a spiritual definition. The definition of nationhood is this spiritual definition. It's a definition of people, part of whose identity is defined by the role they play in the integrated functioning of the larger group. And the possession of political institutions or a piece of geography is secondary. It's only an expression of it. And this then can be communicated on into the next world, because a person there experiences whatever the next world provides him with on the basis of the identity that he has created for himself here. It's the same person. It's the same person, and your activities in this world are self-creative. By acting in this world, you mold yourself, not totally, but partially. You create within the limits set by God's flexibility for you. You create what kind of person you will be. And if you create out of yourself a person with an identity that is partly collective, then in the world to come, that identity is going to be the basis of which you experience it. So the collectivity of the nation can be reproduced there. I haven't said all of it, but I've said part of it. I'll stop the questions now, and then I'll continue. With me so far? No. Okay. Now, before I extend the idea, I want to give you just a model to think about how the individual relates to the group. Consider the cells in your body. Every cell in your body has the same DNA, more or less. Okay, there's sometimes copying mistakes and things like that, but the vast majority of the DNA is the same. That's why cloning works. Cloning takes the DNA from a mature cell, puts it into an egg, in place of the egg's own DNA, and what grows is a genetic copy of you. It won't be a copy in other respects, but it'll be a genetic copy. So in this respect, each cell has in it a recipe for making the whole, the same whole. On the other hand, each cell is differentiated in its size and in its structure and its activity. You have nerve cells and muscle cells and red blood cells and white blood cells and glial cells in the cranium and the cells of your skin and so forth and so on. Now, they're all the same DNA, but if you look at them, they're a different size, different shape. Different internal bodies are functioning because the genes turn these on and turn those off. So on the one hand, each cell is a differentiated part of the body. You can't take a muscle cell and plug it in for a gap in the brain and hope that it'll do a job. It's not a neuron. On the other hand, what they have in common is they all have a complete recipe for the whole of the person. Similarly, every human being is partly a differentiated element in a larger whole, playing a specific role. That part of his identity is really collective. He is a muscle cell, or a neuron, or a red blood cell, or whatever. On the other hand, he had a like apart as well. Abraham wasn't somehow disconnected from God because he didn't have a whole nation to connect to. Each person carries within himself the ability to connect to God on an individual level, and carries within himself this collective identity, which is a part of his ability to connect with God. A full connection with God cannot be achieved unless the collective identity is part of it. The Torah says in more than 30 places that for certain crimes, the punishment is kares. Kares means being cut off. In all texts except one, The Torah says you'll be cut off from your people. The soul will be cut off from its people. One place it says you'll be cut off from God. All the other places it says you'll be cut off from your people. The meaning is that you'll be cut off from God, of course. That's what Koresh is. But the way it's expressed is that you'll be cut off from your people. Because someone who's really cut off from the Jewish people is perforce cut off from God. He can't connect. A large section of the connection goes through one's collective identity as part of the Jewish people. So, what I've said so far is this, that the identity of a person is in part national. That is to say, he plays a part in the national integrated unit. That's part of his identity. That being the case, when he goes into the world to come, that part of his identity is going to be there as who he is. Part of who he is, and he will experience the world to come with the identity that he built for himself in this world. So the first question we started with, how could there be a national entity in the world to come? What gives it nationhood? The answer is, of course, it's not real estate and it's not political institutions, but it is the spiritual reality that underlies political institutions and real estate. And that is this kind of collective identity, integrated functioning of a large collective unity made of many individual people. That's the first step. You with me? Okay, now the second step is this. All I've told you so far is that each person has, as part of his identity, this collective identity. I suppose one could imagine at this point that Reuven goes in with his collective identity, and Shimon goes in with his collective identity, and Levi and Yehuda go with their collective identity. What? But still, each one has that collectivity. You know, I am really the right hand of the nation. I am really the left ear of the nation. I am really the upper lip of the nation. You know, I am really the beard of the nation. Okay, that's who you are. It's part of who you are. Good. We have to imagine more than that. We have to imagine that in the world to come, each person with his collective identity interacts with all the other people so as to reformulate that integrated entity. It's not just that each person has part of himself, his consciousness of what he was once as part of a larger whole, but that consciousness is real, it's true, it's real. And it is part of the experience of the world to come, which means part of the experience of the world to come is collective. Part of the experience is collective. As a simple analogy, if you're playing football, you're one of the 11 people on the team, okay, but the defensive team is 22, very good. And you make that final touchdown in the last 6 seconds of the game, and you're now ahead by 3 points, no, 4 points, they can't even make a field goal. 4 points, and you've won the game, right? And you have that thrill. That thrill is expressed by the words, we won the game. We. The experience is we. The 14 of us together won the game. Because it was a football game. It was a game played by teams. Now every one of the 14 feels a tremendous thrill. Okay, for the tapes, I'm not recommending football. If you don't know who I am, I'm not in favor of necessarily spending all your time playing football or watching football. It's not mine. But I'm just using examples you might be familiar with. So that experience of we did it is part of being an element in a nation. There's a we did it, we accomplished it. When a nation undertakes projects and succeeds, there's a we did it. Now that we did it is an experience. It's an experience that you share, in the case of football, you share it with all the members of the team and with nobody else. Nobody else can share that experience. Because they aren't part of the we that did it. So here also, if the Jewish nation as a whole, as it does, has successes, spiritual successes, and those mold its experience and its collective identity, then that has to be reproduced in the world to come as well. So there's got to be some element of the world to come which is a collective experience based on the integrated structure of nationhood. Are you with me? That's good, because I just made all that up right now. I never thought of this before, but I think it's, I'm very happy. I think I picked up something that I haven't seen before. I think it's quite right. I think it's quite right. Yeah.
Would you say that in terms of the next world, the amount of the experience that will be collected as opposed to individual would like be like directly compared to this world's experience?
I don't know what to say about that. I mean, I have not researched this subject since I just made it up, so I don't know. I'm just as I'm talking to you, I'm realizing that there's a whole element here of the collectivity of the experience. Now, let me add to it one aspect of the way the nation functions in this world, because this is supportive material. There are 613 commandments. The sources tell us that the body and the soul is divided into 613 elements. Each element is nourished by the performance of the corresponding mitzvah. Simple enough idea. Filled with problems. One problem is there's no Jew for whom all 613 mitzvahs apply. Some is only for the high priest, and some is only for a member of the Sanhedrin, and some is only for a king, and some only for men, some only for women. There's no person for whom all 613 mitzvahs apply. No, so does that mean each one of us is sort of withering away? You know, some parts of our bodies and our souls are withering away? Now, there are many answers to this question. But one answer is this. Each Jew's performance provides a spiritual effect that's available to all other Jews. It's as if there's a kind of invisible bloodstream that joins all Jews together. Each mitzvah is like the secretion of a hormone into that bloodstream. And then as the blood circulates in the vessels, that hormone becomes available to everybody. Not, this is what, let me finish, not just now, but throughout time. Throughout time. It's not what the scientists call synchronous at a moment. But it's continuous. That means that mitzvot performed 2,000 years ago created a spiritual reality from which we today can benefit. It's a little bit like this. If you have an incident in your childhood in which you get a scar, chances are that scar will stay with you for the rest of your life. Now, I'm sure some of you know that the material in your body is being replaced continuously. Atoms, molecules are being replaced continuously. Cells are breaking down and being rebuilt. They estimate that there isn't a single molecule in your body today that there was 10 years ago. They've all been broken down and reconstructed. So the actual material out of which you're built is totally new. But the scar is still there. How come? Because the replacements take place in such a way as to preserve the same structure. The same structure is preserved even though composed out of new material. Now, in a rough analogy, the nation goes through an experience. That experience leaves its mark on the nation. The nation's organization may be changed in certain ways. Certain responses are changed in certain ways. Certain priorities are changed in certain ways. Now, people die and people are born. People leave the nation. People join the nation. But that structure in the nation stays the same. Just like the atoms and molecules in your body are being replaced all the time, but the scar stays there. So that structure and that particular mode of interacting and response stays the same. So the spiritual reality created by our ancestors 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago, when they offered sacrifices in the temple, even though the temple is not available to us, nobody is offering sacrifices today. That reality is still available for us because they created a spiritual residue stamped on the identity of the nation. And then since we are members of the same nation, that becomes available to us as well. So here you see, in a way, even in this world, where the nation forms a unity throughout time, and the experience at one time has an effect on the experience at another time, that's a picture of the collective side of identity, which expresses itself in this world. And in the next world, that's going to have an effect on how we experience things in the next world as well. In that sense, at least, we can say that the Jewish nation exists as a nation in the next world. Yes?
Does that apply to the positive as well as the negatives? What was the mitzvot and everything else that was done in the past?
is for the chut, the veros, and so forth, is also part of the identity.
Okay, so we happen now to be learning the way of God by Lutzato. So I'll just remind the others of what we learned last week, that the negative side leaves a residue, but that residue must be expunged. It must be eliminated, eradicated, before you get into the world to come, because there is no evil in the world to come. No evil of any kind. So therefore, in the world to come, all that's left is the residue of the good, not the residue of the evil. So it does create a residue, but it's eliminated before you get there.
Does this work backwards in time as well as forwards in time?
Does this work backwards in time as well as forwards in time? In a certain sense, yes. Yes, it does. You all know this, but you're just not aware of it. You don't pay attention to it. Like, it's not your fault. I'm discovering things now that I've said for thousands of times, and I'm just beginning to realize what they mean. We say when we flop our hate, you know, we do the confession, Aval anachnu va'avoseinu chatonu. We and our ancestors have sinned. Now, listen. Confession is part of repentance. Confession is part of repentance. I can only repent for me. I can't repent for you. It's not going to make any difference. It's not going to make any sense for me to say, and Shimon did this, and Reuven did this. I'm confessing. I'm confessing Shimon's sins. I'm confessing Reuven's sins. That's ridiculous. They have to confess their sins. I should confess my sins. So what are we saying when we say, but we and our ancestors have sinned? You know, why are we throwing a brick at them, so to speak? Instead, I have to worry about our own. And the answer is, the truth, I can't do it for Reuven and Shimon, for the different individuals. But the Jewish people today can do it for the Jewish people 100 years ago, because it's the same Jewish people. It's the same Jewish people. And therefore, when we say it there, we're not saying it individually, we're saying it collectively. Aval anachnu is plural, we. And our ancestors, here we're speaking as a nation, including ourselves, we're speaking as a nation. And the proof of it that I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik of Boston, Rabbi Shalom, many, many years ago is this. When you look at the book of Nehemiah, you see them building the second temple. And they offer sacrifices. Part of what they do is they offer sacrifices for the sin of idol worship in the first temple. Now, those people are gone. 70 years since. So, it's not for the people who are alive who come from that time. But it is possible for a later stage of the Jewish people to offer sacrifices for what an earlier stage did. Indeed, we have a law. Here, everything's integrated. Let's suppose that 17 people contribute together on a sacrifice. They buy the sacrifice together. Chukwas. Partnership. They can do that. Suppose one dies. So then it's all over. You can't do it. Because the sacrifice is identified by the group who's bringing it. And it can't be brought. Let's say it's a chattas. The chattas. So if one dies, then you can't bring it. What happens if it's a a sacrifice of the nation, national sacrifice, like the daily sacrifice or the better even, and this is what the Gemara asks, the musaf of a Rosh Chodesh or something. The new moon, you know, the first of the month, special sacrifices, you take the animals and you designate them and then one gets lost. Okay, you got lost, so you take another one, you do it. 3 weeks later, you find it. Now he's designated as a Rosh Chodesh sacrifice. Okay, in 9 days, there's going to be another Rosh Chodesh. Can I use him again? The problem is that in that month, people will die. If that animal was designated as the Korban Sibur, the communal sacrifice, isn't the same community. Some people are gone. Can you use it? The answer is yes, you can use it. Why? Because Ein Sibur Meis. Because the community doesn't die. So the community is not just a partnership among individuals. With a partnership, one dies, it's over. They don't have the same partnership. The community, the nation, has a life from beyond the individuals. It can be the same Sibur, the same units, even if the individuals, some are replaced by others and some are missing. Anyway, this is all evidence of the idea of a collective identity. There is a collective identity, which is part of the person's identity, and that too will be reproduced in the world to come. Okay. With me so far? Now I've left something out. Anybody got a picture of what I left out? Think back to where we started, the very beginning. I left it out. That's 40 minutes ago. It's unfair.
A Gentile lady.
Yeah. What about a non-Jew? Isn't a non-Jew also part of a nation? Wouldn't that be part of his identity? Wouldn't he have collective experience? Wouldn't he have collective performance? What's going to happen to the national identity of a non-Jew? According to what Lutzato says, their only nation in the world to come is a Jewish nation.
This identity is that of a non-Jew, and that connects all the other non-Jews, and that is the identity of a nation. We have Jews and non-Jews, and connect to that.
But given what I said in naturalistic terms, right, that there, you think of yourself as part of a larger group, you identify with the group, the successes of the group are yours because they're in the we succeeded. Don't Nigerians have that? Don't Greeks have that? Don't the Eskimos have that?
They're not saying it's a conscious thing. Even if you can do something and it's like done collectively and you're not conscious of it, you'll still be involved in it on a collective level. So even a non-Jew doesn't have to be conscious of it. You can still be connected.
Yes, it's true. But understand, all the examples I gave to explain the idea were conscious examples. So it'll be natural to ask, well, if they have all those conscious trappings, how then is it that they don't have a real national identity, or you're not counting it? I mean, you're right. You could jump to the metaphysical and say, okay, forget the conscious trappings. But that's a jump. And then some people will say, if you use the conscious trappings to explain and maybe even give evidence for and convince us that it exists in the Jewish case, then it seems to me I should use it and credit it in the non-Jewish case as well. Yeah.
So, assuming that Goy keeps the shepherd ministers and has entry to Olam Haba. Well, you're saying he goes up to, or she goes up as an individual as opposed to a collective body. The fact that they're in Olam Haba in and of itself, what's the difference if they go up as an individual or they go up as a nation?
Okay, well, what's the difference for us?
What's the difference for us?
So, the idea that I'm exploring now is that just as in this world, you experience certain things collectively. When you win the football game, and you're thrilled, and you say, we won, and you know very well, that's something you could not have done by yourself. Because you can't be a football team. Only 14 people can be a, 22 people can be a football team. Right? So here, the whole experience, the whole meaning, the whole structure is collective. Now, if there are events like that in this world, and they become part of your identity, so that's part of who you are. If that's part of who you are, when you go to the world to come, you're bringing along who you are. That's the difference that it'll be. If that part weren't serviced, so to speak, if that part didn't play a role in the experience of the world to come, then it's part of you that's being left behind. So, as I told you, I only thought this up 10 minutes ago, so it's hard. But I'll tell you what occurs to me. First of all, yes, I mean, I'm going in your direction, but I've got to work at it. There's the experience of being a nation, being a part of an integrated whole, engaging in collective activities. And then there is the question of what are the activities that the collectivity is trying to achieve? What is it dedicated to? How central is it? How important is it? How much of the essence of the human being is really being expressed? Let's imagine 3 4-year-olds collectively building a sandcastle at the beach. Well, the boys are like 5 years. Let's imagine a team of 20 super programmers working on the next generation of the Intel chips. Working together in an integrated fashion. Let's imagine there's a thing called, I think, Doctors International, something like that, where they go all over the world and they offer their services. And there's a raging epidemic in Somalia, and 200 doctors go on, and then they have a command center. 10 of them set up a command center, and they're in charge of the activities of 200 doctors. Supply, strategy, triage, you know, the whole thing. You can imagine groups of people working integratedly for different kinds of goals. You say, oh my God, sandcastles? Okay, that's for 5 years. Right. But as an adult, I wouldn't sit with two other people on the beach and collect a sandcastle. Yeah, they'd be cooperating. We'd be cooperating on something trivial. IBM, well, it's a good way to make money. You know, Big Blue. They're non-trivial problems. Non-trivial problems. Solving computing problems. Yeah, right. Here, with the doctors, you're saving lives. You're stemming an epidemic. It's also very, very complicated. Organizing a medical effort like that is very, very complicated. I can imagine 10 people working together as a team. Not all teams are equal, even though when you experience the integration, it feels the same, but it doesn't reach the same level of the human being. It's not the same level of the human being that's involved in the integration. With a child, there's much less of the human being there at that age. With the IBM worker, he's working on an interesting intellectual problem to make money and to compete for the with the doctors that are saving lives in an emergency. Now, the doctor's case is already bordering on spirituality. You can imagine working collectively on the spiritual perfection of the universe. That's going to touch and integrate the deepest elements in a human being. It's the deepest elements in the human being that are integrated into the collective effort and the collective experience. Whereas others are more superficial. So, you'll take the Nigerians or the Eskimos or South Africans and ask, okay, they're integrated, they feel integrated. You know, they're acting as a unit and they feel success together, but what are they succeeding? Act. And here, the Amchal's scripture is not too bad. They're succeeding at their own physical challenges, war and peace, economy, technology, science, healthcare, and so forth and so on. They're succeeding at their own spiritual challenges. Do they have a just society or an unjust society? Charitable society? On the other side, creative, artistic, and so forth and so on. But that's all. So it's very, how should I put it, self-centered. It's very self-centered, and it's limited in what aspects of the human being are engaged in the integrative process. When you have an integration of the Jewish people, where the integration is necessary and sufficient for perfecting the universe as a whole, then that national structure integrates the person on the deepest possible level. So it's going to be a qualitatively different level of integration. Even though psychologically they feel the same, you see what I've done. It's a qualitatively different level of integration, even though it feels the same, but the inner essence of it, the inner reality of it is different. Now, one more aspect, and then maybe this will help. I don't know if this fully explains it, but it's help, I think. We mentioned briefly, he says at the end of the chapter that what happens in this world to the non-Jewish nations is largely, mostly, to enable the Jewish people to carry out its task of perfecting the universe. In other words, they play the role of the environment, the scenery, and those who provide elements necessary for us to carry out our task. So already in this world, their whole identity, even their integration as nations, is being dedicated to what it can contribute to our career. So in the next world, if they come in as individuals without the national structure and are adjuncts to us, it more or less fits what their position is in this world. So the double answer I'm giving, maybe this is 80% of the job, the double answer I'm giving is number one, the integration of their nations does not reflect the deepest reality. Even though it feels strong, but it doesn't reflect the deepest reality. And number two, whatever integration they have, it is for the sake of what it contributes to the Jewish nation anyhow. That might be enough to, anyway, the partial explanation of why their national structure is not reproduced in the world today. Alright? You heard it first. Yeah.
They might be in the world to come get any connection to the fact that they were helping them in this world to the collective activity.
Okay, the word he uses here, he says they are nosefes, which means added, nispachas, which means nispachas, like an appendix in a book or an addendum. You know, at the end of the book, you put on a little extra paragraph, which you sort of add on at the end. Nitpalim, they're tafel, which means they're secondary. And then he gives an example, like levush, like a garment.
So there's still a connection there.
There's a connection. There's a connection. Now, what does a garment do? A garment helps me do what I have to do. So it's secondary in that respect. You know, it reflects that secondary nature that they of the roles they played in this world. Yeah.
In this world, do different nations accomplish different things in regard to the Jews, and therefore they'll in the next world also be defined as like a unit accomplishing?
So this is it. He says that. Oh, see, he got me. He caught it. Why did I say 80%? Because that's what I have. That's what I left out. This is exactly what I left out. Still, put them in there as nations, and have them playing the secondary role as nations to us that they played in this world. That's why I said it was 80%. I said it's based on a lower principle, maybe therefore it could be dissolved, but I did lead out there. He got it exactly right. That's the 20% that I don't see exactly. Why not put them in there as nations, but as secondary? So there's got to be something else that the national unit is doing in the world to come that I'm not picking up. So, as I say, it's progress, but it's not 100%.
If the next world is really the highest reality, and you can't take something which is not connected to the highest reality and put it up there in terms of what they are, because they're not that highest reality. They
That's
have to be
true.
Connected to
but listen to his question. In this world, those nations do provide something for the Jewish people. And as he said, it's quite true that each nation provides something else. Each nation has its theme, so to speak. And, from Norway, you're not going to get email.
If you're providing for the higher reality in this world and you're not part of that higher reality, then in the next world you can only be connected to that higher reality. You can't be part of the reality itself.
Let's say so. But why can't you be connected as a nation? Reproduce the national unit in the next world and just be connected to the Jewish nation in the next world. As a nation, right? That's excellent point, and I don't have a full understanding of that. Yeah.
We spoke earlier about slices of souls and stuff like that. How does the slices of souls relate to which nation person or if person belongs to the Jewish nation or the soul belongs to this nation? Because you can have a slice of soul that is part of a slice of soul that ends up not being Jewish and a slice of soul that ends up being Jewish. So where do you...
I'm not sure. I'll tell you, there's an ambiguity that I'm not sure how to resolve, and with that, well, I'll have to leave it. People say things like, there are bigger souls and smaller souls, greater souls and less great souls. I don't know. I discussed this with my son Thursday night, and we couldn't come to a conclusion. I don't know whether that means that the souls are intrinsically different from one another, or whether the amount of a soul that's allowed to express itself in its career in this world is different. We know that the great majority of the soul can't express itself in this world. We spoke about that. the body can't carry it, it will be obliterated if the soul did that. So we know that a great deal is sort of cut off. Only the lower reaches of the soul integrate with the body, interact with the body, and are affected directly by what goes on here, and can affect what directly what goes on. So we talk about different souls. Are we talking about what is allowed to express itself in this world? But really, in and of themselves, they're really all the same? Or are there inherent differences among souls? If there are differences, it's going to cause a problem in terms of justice. Now, I know one source, but it needs more than one source to settle it. There's a Ma'or v'Shomesh, one of the early great Hasidic works, on Shiras Miriam, when Miriam leads the women in song. And it says that she led them in a circle. The men didn't sing altogether. They didn't have instruments, and certainly didn't make a circle. So Ma'or v'Shomesh quotes from certain sources of the idea of a circle. The idea of a circle is that all points on the circle are equivalent. And he says this is a symbol of the condition of the world to come, where all the souls will be equivalent. And he says explicitly that the difference between men and women will dissolve. Because the difference between men and women is not essential to the soul. It's not essential to the soul. It's just how the soul is allowed to express itself in this world. Souls are not male or female. People who are souls plus bodies, and the bodies then are differentiated by sex. People with the body as part of their expression are male or female, but the soul is not male or female. So whatever that means, that source indicates that what the differences you have in this world are only differences of what's allowed to express itself. It's not inherent differences in the soul itself. But there may be other sources, and I can't fully answer it. Okay.